The tire tracks they followed curved in the direction of the vultures. The descent was difficult, holding the heavy machines on low gear and riding the brakes. Within a few minutes, they rolled into a gloomy, stone-littered swale overlooked by a rocky buttress rising ominously 50 feet above them. It formed a giant headstone for the bullet-riddled corpse of a dead Indian and a pinto pony. The three people stayed in the saddles, studying the scene. Judging by the consistency of the blood glistening on the ground, man and horse had been killed within the past hour. Kane read the whole story quickly. The dead Indian was a young brave who had apparently attacked the hellhounds wielding only a lance. It lay nearby, the wooden shaft splintered by automatic fire. Whether he had wounded one of the ex-mags was strictly a matter of conjecture, but at least three streams of 9mm autofire dropped him and his war pony dead. His bullet-perforated rawhide shield bore the red and yellow cross within the diamond symbol of the Lakota.
Think we should give him a burial?
The ground is frozen solid, and rocky as hell, too. It would take us the rest of the day to dig a grave.
It just seems disrespectful to leave him here.
It's more respectful to catch his killers. Get down!
Kane leapt from the motorcycle's saddle, unlimbering his copperhead in the same motion, questing for targets. He found half a dozen. Sitting on ponies atop the granite rim above the swale, he saw men with their coppery faces distorted by red and yellow paint, their eyes glittering with naked hatred. They wore fringed deerskin shirts and leggings. Feathers adorned their long black hair. The Sioux, mounted in the center, braced the butt of a Winchester against his shoulder, sighting down its length.
Fire with Chester!
Kane, do you understand what he said?
Yeah. He said murderer.
Kane dived to the hard ground, landing on his left shoulder.
Shit!
He tucked, rolled, and came up on his right knee. He fired the copperhead upward one-handed, not really aiming. At the same instant, Grant opened up with his own subgun, twisting awkwardly on the motorcycle seat. The two weapons hammered out twin rattling drum beats, and gouts of dirt exploded from the rim of the overhang. Grit and gravel burst up in fountains. The ponies of the Indians shied and reared, neighing in panic. The ponies backed away from the rim in eye-rolling terror. The Sioux with the Winchester resolutely struggled to stay astride his horse and return the fire, but his wild shots didn't come close to the Cerberus warriors. Leaping from her motorcycle, Bridget raised both arms over her head.
Hey-ya! Kolapi! Kolapi!
The Sioux swiveled the rifle barrel toward her, and she pointed to Kane.
Unktomi shunkaha! Unktomi shunkaha!
At those words, the Lakota peered over his rifle, rather than sighting down its length. They saw his lips move as he repeated Kane's Sioux name. It meant Trickster Wolf. It had been bestowed upon him by a warrior named Standing Bear, who had also given him the thin scar traversing his left cheek. The Lakota turned his head toward his companions.
Kolapi, Unktomi shunkaha!
The feather-bedecked man thrust up the Winchester high over his head with both hands, a peace sign. Kane slowly climbed to his feet. He didn't aim his copperhead at the Indians on the overhang, but he didn't lower it either.
Thanks, Baptiste.
Saying no, we're friends didn't work. But telling them they were shooting at the lovely and talented Trickster Wolf stopped the fireworks.
Good thing you're so popular, Kane. Is this a bunch of Sky Dogs boys, or are you a household name in every Indian village now?
Unktomi shunkaha!
The voice came from behind them. Kane whirled, leading with the copperhead. Sky Dog and four Lakota moved into the open, sidling around a scattering of boulders where they had apparently been hidden.
Son of a bitch. Sky Dog, you have no idea how glad I am to see it's your gang shooting at us.
The shaman's rigid features didn't twitch in even an imitation of a smile. Although he had no weapon, his right hand didn't stray far from the butt of the auto pistol thrust through his beaded belt. The other warriors wielded a variety of firearms, all provided, ironically enough, by the Cerberus Armory. They regarded the outlanders with glittering eyes, bright and wary. They cradled their guns so the barrels pointed Kane's way.
In truth, I don't know how I feel about seeing you three out here, Kane.
Surely you don't think we had anything to do with this man's death.
Did you?
You know better than that. Or you damn well ought to after all this time.
Perhaps I do. But my people want to know what you're doing here in the lands of the Lakota and the Cheyenne. They are very keen to find out. Is that so?
Kane cradled his weapon in such a way that the boar fixed on the tallest of the warriors.
Blue Cloud pursued four magistrates on motorcycles. I count three of them here.
Three is not the same as four. At least, it wasn't the last time I checked.
And the last time I checked, the three of us weren't magistrates.
Then what the hell are you doing out here? You're a long way from home.
We're chasing four magistrates on motorcycles, and you're as long away from home as we are.
Perhaps we should parley. Compare notes on why we're all so far from home. It might be our reasons are related.
Good idea. This inscrutable, noble, savage act of yours is starting to get on my nerves.
I thought you knew, Kane. It's meant to.
Skydog's village lay in the tableland in the foothills of the Bitterroot Range, and as such, the mixed band of Sioux and Cheyenne were Cerberus Redoubt's nearest neighbors. Well over 2 years before, direct contact had been established between the Redoubt's personnel and the tribe's people. Kane had managed to turn a potentially tragic misunderstanding into an alliance with Skydog. Not so much a chief as a shaman, a warrior priest, Skydog was Cobaltville bred like they were. Unlike them, he had been exiled from the Ville while still a youth due to his Lakota ancestry. He joined the band of Amerindians living around the Bitterroots and eventually earned a position of high authority and respect among them. Part of that position was to serve as the keeper of his people's great secret, the War Wag. According to tribal lore, more than a century before, a group of Wasikan adventurers had ridden inside the iron belly of a pre-dark mobile command post up the single treacherous road wending its way around deep ravines to the mountain plateau. When the vehicle made its return journey, it ran out of fuel, and the Amerindians had set upon the people inside it. After presumably killing them all, they had hidden the huge machine and removed all of its weapons, except the fixed emplacements. When a set of circumstances brought Grant, Bridget, and Kane first into conflict, then alliance with the Indians, Skydog proposed the residents of Cerberus make the MCP operational again. They had agreed, since a fully restored and armed War Wag would make a solid first line of defense against a possible incursion from Cobaltville. The task to bring back to life a machine that had lain dormant for at least 100 years entailed far more effort and time than any of them, particularly Kane, who had acted as the Cerberus diplomatic envoy, had foreseen. Periodically, over a stretch of months, Grant and Kane visited the Indian settlement to complete the refitting of the MCP. The front-mounted 20mm cannons had been repaired, the side and rear rocket pods made fully functional, and a drum-fed RPK light machine gun reinstalled in the roof turret. Once the huge vehicle was completely operational with all of its weaponry in perfect working order, it became a true dreadnought, a mobile skirmish line far superior to the Ville Sandcats. Those efforts had earned Kane his high standing among the tribe's people. The name Trickster Wolf was at first conceived as an insult, then it became synonymous with cunning and courage after he orchestrated a Lakota victory over the Magistrate Assault Force. While the body of Blue Cloud was attended to, Skydog drew the Cerberus warriors aside to confer. They were joined by the Winchester-toting Bear in the Woods and two other high-ranking Kit Foxes. Kane recalled meeting them during his frequent visits to the village, but they were considerably less cordial than before. Even before the incursion of Team Phoenix had resulted in so many Lakota deaths, the influence of the Soldier Society on the band had increased. Since then, the Kit Foxes seemed to wield more and more authority. Kane in particular wasn't pleased by the prospect for a number of reasons. First and foremost, a political upheaval among the Sioux could have a serious impact on the security of Cerberus. He had kept his visits to the settlement at a minimum since that incident, so as not to inflame anti-Wasikun passions. He viewed the Indian village as something of a holiday resort, a vacation getaway when he suffered from Redoubt fever. No one asked what he did down there among the Amerindians, but after remaining with the band for a few days, Kane would show back up at the Cerberus installation, oftentimes dirty and disheveled, but always relaxed. Grant and Bridget often wondered if Kane had a willing harem of Indian maidens, who always looked forward to a visit from Unktomi Shunkaha, but they never inquired about it. The truth was a little more metaphysical than seeking a sexual release. With the recent influx of female emigres from the Menetius moonbase, Kane had no lack of willing partners. He felt a strong affinity for Skydog's wild and free people and their unfettered way of life. Perhaps it had something to do with the vision he had glimpsed some years before during a bad gateway transit. At the time, he had dismissed it as a dream caused by an out-of-phase Mattrans lock. Lakesh had explained long ago that when the modulation frequencies of two gateway units weren't in perfect sync, jump sickness would result, a symptom of which was startlingly vivid hallucinations. The hallucinations Kane had suffered weren't mere dreams. They were more like glimpses of past lives, vignettes from his soul's journey over the long track of time. In one of the visions, he had seen himself astride a pony, feathers in his long streaming hair, as he galloped down on the Bluecoat soldiers in a place called Greasy Grass. The soldier's chief had been named Pahaska. It wasn't until much later, delving secretly into the Cerberus database, that he learned Greasy Grass was what the Lakota called the Little Bighorn, and Pahaska's Wasikun name was Custer. Kane had wondered why such obscure historical details that weren't in his conscious storehouse of knowledge would bubble to the surface during a bout of jump sickness. Following that incident, after gaining pieces of the Chintamani stone, Lakesh postulated that so-called jump dreams might not be hallucinations at all, but brief inchoate peaks into other lives and other realities. The Cerberus and Lakota warriors sat inside a circle of stones, munching pemmican and strips of dried elk meat offered by Bear in the Woods. Grant, Kane, and Brigid forced it down without registering much revulsion. A few of their MRE packs weren't superior in the area of flavor. However, they did insist on providing the water, distilled and carried in sealed bottles.
"Why are you here?"
Brigid narrowed her eyes at his autocratic tone, but she answered him for the benefit of the others. Skydog already knew about the fall of the baronies and the anarchy that overwhelmed many of them. She told him about reports from a roamer band that led Cerberus to investigate the tales of the Hellhounds and then embark on a mission to stop their raids.
That was accomplished early this morning. All but four are dead.
It is good.
Domi and Lakesh are on their way to Sweetwater Station in the convoy?
Yes.
Skydog signaled a warrior to approach him. The shaman spoke quietly but urgently into his ear. When he was done, the Lakota ran to his pony, leaped onto its back, and galloped furiously away.
Where is he going?
I sent goes ahead to spread the word to the other bands in the region not to attack the convoy, to let it pass in peace.
Smart move, seeing as how Domi is aboard. The Sioux would take more losses than any possible gain.
We have heard much of the Wakansika Yanka, the Hellhounds, ourselves. When they crossed our path, Blue Cloud struck out on his own after them. The rest of us followed at a distance. Then we heard gunfire. We waited, but Blue Cloud never returned. We spotted his body only moments before you arrived.
You're not out here to hunt the Hellhounds down.
No, they are only the curs.
Let me guess. You're after the leader of the pack, a man named Benedict Snow.
I have met with the man you name, but no, he is not the one I seek. A clever and ruthless man he is, but at this stage he's only a pawn.
In whose game?
That is a difficult question to answer. I have cudgeled my brains deep into the night, seeking the answer. I have no choice but to accept the obvious. It is a game played by a man who died at least 325 years ago. Tawasi, the Owl Prophet.
Skydog flicked his eyes back and forth across the faces of Kane, Brigid, and Grant. They returned his gaze stolidly.
You don't seem very skeptical about such a crazy statement.
We've heard crazier and seen worse.
I should have known.
Even so, it probably wouldn't hurt to explain what you mean.
It has to do with a holy object of my people. It is called the Taimei. It is a heaven-sent stone. I don't expect it to mean anything to you, but...
He broke off when he saw Kane angling ironic eyebrows in Bridget's direction.
What? Baptiste, if you would be so kind.
The Taimei has been compared by Indian historians to the Ark of the Covenant. It was a symbol of religious veneration not entirely dissimilar to the sacred statues, paintings, and other relics so highly regarded by the religions of other races throughout the world.
And do you know why?
According to myth, it contained the essence of the grandfather, basically the spirit of God. There were 10 lesser idols, the Adulbeaya, which translates as grandmother gods. They were preserved in pouches made of human scalps. They were held in respect only slightly less than that accorded the Taimei.
How do you know all this?
I studied and remembered.
It helps to have a photographic memory and access to probably the most comprehensive database on the planet.
You seem to know more than most of my own people.
That's really not unusual. Most of these stories were all oral history, even 300 years ago. Although native religions were studied and reported upon by a number of ethnologists throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, it's doubtful if all the permutations were made understandable, even to the Indians themselves.
What do you mean?
The cosmogony of deities and rituals were too vague and indefinite, too wrapped up in contradictory legend and folklore, particularly the Sundance ceremonies.
My village practices them, but much of the meaning behind the rituals has been lost, particularly since we perform them without the unifying symbol of the Taimé. I fear it's just going through the motions.
I know. But according to the information I studied, the Sundances were more than simple religious ceremonies. They were festivals, a combined church social and picnic, even a family reunion. Old friends and relatives met for the first time in perhaps a year. Warrior societies held meetings, elections, and initiations. Young men met their future wives. Newborn infants were medicated and charmed against disease and epidemic by the shamans. The whole religious atmosphere of the tribe was toned up and given a rebirth. The achievements of warriors of the past year were given proper publicity, and growing boys launched in their careers as full-fledged members of the tribe. The institution tended to maintain tribal and racial solidarity, and through its influence, the traditions of the people were preserved.
Why is it called a Sundance?
A large east-facing lodge is built for the ceremony, and a forked pole is erected in the center. In the fork, we place sacred objects. Long ago, it was the Taimé. The young warriors dance around the pole, always facing the sacred objects. They dance until exhaustion, going without food or water until they collapse. Then a shaman cuts two small holes through the skin and muscle on both sides of their chests and sticks wooden skewers through the holes and ties them to two ropes. The ends are fastened to the forked ends of the pole. The warriors dance again, straining against the ropes. Once they have received their visions from the grandfather, the ropes will break and free them.
This sounds like it hurts like hell.
Every single time.
Skydog opened his tunic, revealing two vertical raised wheels on his pectorals.
Then why do it?
When the ceremony is over, the tribe can count on enjoying health, fertility, and food. The world is renewed, its harmonies restored, ready once more to work for the welfare of the people. Or it used to be so when the Taimé was involved.
All of that invested in a rock?
It's a Lakota thing. You wouldn't understand.
We might understand more than you give us credit for. If the Taimé was so important, hasn't any Indian looked for it after all these centuries?
No.
Why not?
Because we've known where it was since the 1870s.
The shaman hitched around on the rock and waved toward the broken line of mountains jutting up from the horizon.
There, atop Medicine Mountain, buried beneath the Tohan Pejuta in the Wanagi Awapeyata.
Beneath the what and the where now?
So there are some gaps in your knowledge. I'm glad to hear that. It's beneath the medicine wheel, in the place where souls wait.
Well, what the hell is that?
A cavern, or so I'm told. A network of caverns.
Why is it there?
To contain a great evil. And now, that evil may be released to spread a far more monstrous form of tyranny on the world than the barons ever schemed. It shames me to admit that some of our own are involved in the dark plan. We know that after the skies grew dark, terrible days overtook everyone, no matter their race or skin color. But there are some among the Lakota who believe that Wakantanka, the grandfather, meant to destroy everyone who is not one of the so-called indigenous peoples.
Hardliners.
There are a few soldier societies who still maintain that the Wasikan are our mortal enemies, whom we must outwit and kill before they destroy us again. It is the fear of the pre-dark days returning that makes them want to kill all who are not like them.
Bridget glanced over at Bear in the Woods, who sat cross-legged atop a rock, obviously not understanding the conversation, but assuming Skydog would provide him with the gist of it later.
You're not talking about the Kit Foxes, are you?
No, but there are a few warriors among them who feel that way. I speak now of the Lynx soldiers.
I don't believe I've heard of them.
I would be surprised if you had. Even my own village no longer speaks of them, or of their leader. They were banished from the tribe because they sought their own path with no regard for the consequences of their actions or what might befall their brethren.
Who was their chief?
Her name is Catamount.
Her name? A woman is the chieftain of a warrior society?
All of the Link's soldiers are women. Many things have changed since the sky fell.
Traditions fell, too.
There were women warrior societies among the Blackfeet, but I never heard of any among the various bands of Sioux.
Catamount is not a full-blooded Lakota. Her father was Spotted Hawk, my mentor. When he died, I inherited his title of shaman.
Sky Dog touched the white feather dangling behind his ear, and a chunk of polished turquoise inserted into a loop on his belt.
Who was her mother?
No one knows. Spotted Hawk refused to say. It's thought she was a witch from the Absaraki, the Crows. The women of the Crow tribe are the most winsome of all native peoples, and often suspected of having magical powers. Others say Catamount's mother was an Akeri, a female demon who seduces men in their dreams.
Which corresponds to the legend of the succubi. When Spotted Hawk died, did Catamount resent you for assuming his position in the village?
Yes. Her heart was filled with much bitterness. As a girl, though devoted to her people, she could be cruel and ungovernable. That was why she was not trained in the arts as I was. But it wasn't jealousy that turned her heart so black. When her father was killed in a Roamer raid, Catamount lost all sense of restraint. She was captured and raped repeatedly. After many days, she managed to kill several of the Roamers and returned to the village. When she heard the wailing of the women mourning the dead, Catamount decided to become a warrior herself. She undertook a vision quest in the wilderness and claimed that the spirit of the mountain lion, the panther, entered her.
Interesting.
You might say that. Particularly since she returned with a huge cougar as her companion. She named him Iwotaka Winconte.
Roughly translated, that means death maul?
Exactly. She somehow tamed it. Some said the devil cat had found a more savage heart in her breast and yielded to it. After that, she formed her own warrior society, the Lynx Soldiers.
To protect the Lakota?
No. For hate. For revenge. For power. There was a streak of arrogance, of cruelty in Catamount long before the Roamers captured her.
What brought about her banishment from the tribe?
No single incident. It was cumulative. While we Council of Chiefs negotiated with the Crow, she would raid their hunting parties. When white traders from the Vils crossed the farthermost lands of our territory, instead of leaving them alone, she would draw their attention by staging attacks. She harried Roamer bands most of all, traveling hundreds of miles to seek them out.
She sounds rather obsessive, but courageous.
Brave, but reckless. Not a good combination.
I thought being the bravest of the brave was the whole point of a warrior society. Promotion to the next higher orders is through merit alone, right?
True, but Catamount and her lynxes didn't plan their sorties well. Although I have no solid proof of it, I have long suspected it was her attacks on the Roamers that drew Leloup Garou to our village. I'm sure you remember that.
Kane only nodded, not needing the reminder of the time Leloup Garou's Roamers attacked Skydog's settlement and carried off captives. Only by his, Bridget's, and Grant's timely intervention had the prisoners been freed. And only by the intervention of Skydog had Kane avoided being buried alive by Leloup Garou.
The Lynx soldiers were away from the village that day, on a foolish mission which garnered them nothing. No plunder, no ponies, no coups. When they returned, the Council of Chiefs ordered Catamount to disband the Lynxes. She refused, choosing exile instead. Most of the women followed her. Catamount accused us of repeating the suicidal short-sightedness of our ancestors. She claimed we would bring down on ourselves the same doom as befell our forefathers at the hands of the Wasikon. She swore she would do anything to keep that from happening. Use any weapon, no matter how foul. Commit any sacrilege.
The Taimei. She's manipulating the Millennial Consortium into recovering the Taimei for her. Is that the sacrilege you mean?
There is more to it than that. If the Medicine Wheel's holy alignment of stones is dislodged, if the Taimei is removed from the place of souls, then the Baycock will awaken.
Baycock? I'm not familiar with that word.
Is that an animal or a man or what?
Was a man. Long, long ago, my people feared the Baycock. The drums and storytellers spoke of them. It was once a death sentence to even speak of a Baycock to a Wasikan. The Baycock is one of the grandfather's forbidden secrets, a mistake in his divine plan. A Baycock is no longer human. It knows no love, no family, no tribe. It has joined with the creatures of the Black World, those that exist in the gulf between nightmares and waking. It can be slain by steel, but unless it is slain, it will never die. It can only be contained. It lives forever, dwelling in eternal darkness. The passage of years means nothing to a Baycock, an hour or a century, all as one. It can control humans if their hearts are hard, and it can command the lifeless body of an evil person until the last drop of their blood has fallen. As long as blood flows, the corpse is its servant. Its only pleasure is inviting the darkness within the human soul and feasting upon it, as a starving man will gorge himself on food. To seek the Taimei is to seek the Baycock.
So, according to your legends, a Baycock guards the Taimei, like the old stories of dragons guarding treasures.
It is no legend, and I mean the exact opposite. I thought you understood.
Maybe I would if you talked in facts instead of folklore.
Very well. Fact one. If Catamount gains the Taimei, she will free the Baycock, who is Towasi, the Owl Prophet, the sorcerer whose capture the Lakota and the Kiowa sacrificed the Taimei in order to imprison him within Medicine Mountain nearly 400 years ago. Now do you understand?
They resumed their journey, leaving the motorcycles behind. They continued tracking the hellhounds on horseback, carrying most of their equipment with them. Skydog had arranged for three of the kit foxes to volunteer to lend their ponies to Unktomi Shunkaha and his two companions. The trio of Lakota didn't seem happy about the prospect of waiting mountless in such a gloomy place, despite the fact that the three people were Okastonka, famous all over the plains. To ease their dissatisfaction, the Cerberus warriors gave them several MRE packages, although Kane silently wondered how long their good moods would last once they dug into them. As tiresome a diet as pemmican and jerked venison could be, he figured they would taste like gourmet treats after the Indians ate a couple of the ration packs. Although the MREs contained all the minerals, vitamins, and proteins a human needed to keep healthy, they all seemed to share one of two flavors, bland or repulsive. No middle ground seemed to exist, and even the most undiscriminating of palates eventually ended up in a form of shock. As it was, neither Bridget nor Grant particularly enjoyed being on horseback again. With only blankets serving as saddles, riding the Indian ponies wasn't much different from trying to keep their balance while straddling a split-rail fence for a couple of hours. The toes of Grant's boots nearly dragged in the dirt. Kane, however, didn't mind. He loved horses, even though his experience with them was limited. At one time, he had considered trading with the Lakota for a remuda of ponies so the Cerberus exiles would have alternate means of transportation to and from the plateau. He had discarded the idea when Bridget and Lakesh reasonably pointed out that the animals would require a great deal of time and care, and they weren't about to muck out whatever lodgings Kane found for the horses.
You mentioned you had met Benedict Snow. How did that come about?
Over the years, I've received reports of the Millennial Consortium's activities around holy sites, and not just the Lakota ones. Acting on rumors, I investigated their supposed presence at Carver's Cave. There I met Benedict Snow. He claimed to be an archaeologist, seeking only to preserve the lost knowledge of our people. I suspected he was a liar. But I knew it for sure when Snow asked me questions about the location of the Taimei. I didn't take action against the Millennialists. They were too well armed for a direct attack to result in anything but a massacre of my people. And I thought that, with the lack of information from which Benedict Snow could work, his search for the Taimei would end in failure or death, especially if he and his crew wandered into Apache country in the deep southwest. A few weeks ago, word reached us that Catamount had been seen among the Millennialists traveling across the Bighorn Basin. I grew worried that Catamount's father, Spotted Hawk, had possibly told her of the Taimei's location. I sent four young kit foxes in training on a spying mission to Medicine Mountain. Only Fleet Deer returned, and he lived just long enough to confirm my fears.
Fortunately for Grant and Bridget, the party of Sioux and Outlanders didn't travel very far. They followed the tire tracks until they reached a narrow, rocky pass. Navigating it would be slow and arduous on motorcycles, and not much easier on horseback. They dismounted, leaving the 7 Kit Fox soldiers to wait for them. They climbed a hill, descended, climbed another, and halfway down the next slope saw the surface of the Powder River winking in the late afternoon sunlight. They all peered through ruby-coated lenses of identical binoculars. On the banks of the river sprouted dry, leafless willow trees and snarled thickets of briar. Set back in a grove of winter-dead cottonwoods was a flat-roofed blockhouse. Rust-pitted corrugated metal covered the walls. The visible windows were crisscrossed with iron slats. They were meant to serve more as gun ports than a means of letting light and air into the building. 4 motorcycles stood outside the building on the hard-packed earth.
Looks like an old toll-taker station.
Years before, self-styled toll-takers staked out and barricaded sections of road or river crossings and charged exorbitant and sometimes bloody fees to travelers.
This used to be a trading post, long ago.
Kane nodded absently, still scanning the immediate area around the structure, looking for camouflaged machine gun nests. He saw none, but he knew from experience most of the outland trading stations were heavily guarded and fortified. Very close to the riverbank, he spotted an oblong wooden structure resembling a slightly oversized upright coffin and guessed it was an outhouse. The few people who lived in the territory brought their trade items to the station on designated days, things they'd made, trapped, or grown, or salvaged. And they bartered with traveling traders for other goods. Judging by the condition of the place, business had fallen off dramatically over the past decade. If not for the parked motorcycles, he would have assumed the place had been abandoned long ago.
Look off to your right.
Skydog, Grant, and Kane did so, and saw a dock made of splintery planks extending from the bank near the rear of the building. The rushing water foamed white at the support posts, the current running swiftly southward. He figured the water was deep, and due to the mountain meltwater, exceptionally cold. A bulky barge, nearly 30 feet long and almost 20 feet wide, was tied up at the end of the dock. The barge looked as if it had been put together with everything from old automobile parts to driftwood. A small box-shaped wooden superstructure formed a pilot house. Rubber tires roped to the hull acted as cushions of sorts as the current bumped it incessantly against the pilings of the dock. A paddle wheel contrivance with wide wooden blades enclosed within a wire cage protruded from the stern, nearly spanning the breadth of the barge. It in turn was connected by a long black rubber belt to the flywheel of a big diesel engine mounted at the back of the craft. Canvas shrouded a tall, upright object bolted to the deck amidships. The words, "Crazy Woman," were painted on the bow in bright red letters. They contrasted so starkly with the drab colors of the rest of the barge that at first glance they looked almost fluorescent. Kane lowered his binoculars.
Now we know how the Hellhounds transported their goods and labor to the consortium's operation.
Yeah, and now that we know, what are we going to do about it?
Kill them. What else?
That's tempting. But let's try to get some information first before we go throat slitting.
I don't think they're going to be in a talkative or sharing mood.
Skydog fingered the long handle of the steel-bladed tomahawk hanging from his belt.
My people can be very persuasive.
I'm aware of that. But revenge for your nephew should come after we get what we need.
Grant tilted his head back, eyeing the position of the sun through the tree branches.
Whatever we're going to do, it ought to be soon while we can still see what we're doing. It gets big time dark out here.
If the Hellhounds looted the Cobaltville Armory, they could have everything from mortars to flamethrowers in there.
I'll go back and fetch my men.
No. By the time you get back, it'll be full dark. I'd rather do this while we still have a little light.
Do what?
Our tried and true strategy of brazening it out.
Oh.
Kane sauntered from the tree line, affecting a casual, relaxed gait, as if he had been out picking wildflowers and become bored. In reality, his stomach muscles were knotted in the same way they had when he was a magistrate, preparing to kick open a door to a pest hole down in the Tartarus pits. But he knew once the bullets began to fly, he would be loose and fast, anything but relaxed. As he approached the trading post, he pretended a desultory interest in the 4 motorcycles resting on their kickstands. He paused to examine them, carefully withdrawing a blunt cigar from a jacket pocket. Placing the end of it in his mouth, he set it afire with a simple flint and steel lighter. He began smoking with what appeared to be a preoccupied intensity. He peered through the wreath of gray smoke, eyes searching for blastermen atop the roof or hidden at the edge of the riverbank. He saw no one and nothing. Surreptitiously, alert for anything that looked like a gun barrel, he glanced toward the barred window, catching shifting shadows from within. Kane figured the hellhounds inside would choose one of two strategies: shoot him down before he reached the door, or admit him and then shoot him down once he was trapped inside. He puffed on his cigar, and when no object that resembled a gun poked out from between the bars, he guessed the ex-mags had talked it over and decided to adopt the latter strategy. He took a few slow steps closer to the door and removed the cigar from his mouth.
Hello! In this shithole!
Hey! What the fuck do you want?
For right now, I want to talk.
Got nothing to talk about, you bastard!
That's where you're so very wrong. Is Carthew in there?
I'm here, Kane.
You don't sound so good. Why, whatever could be wrong?
I'm dying. That's what's wrong. I'm all busted up inside thanks to Grant and his goddamn rocket launcher.
Funny you should mention that. Guess who's aiming what at your exclusive men's lodge right now?
Yeah, figures. How the hell did you find us?
Meaningfully, Kane nudged the rear wheel of a motorcycle with the toe of a boot.
Oh, did you come across any Indians while you trailed us?
Just the kid and his pony you shot and killed. Not very sporting.
Hell, it's not like the little son of a bitch gave us any choice. We tried to scare him off, but the kid wouldn't scare.
How about you? Do you scare?
What do you mean?
I mean I want some information. You can either give it to me without me having to persuade you, or Grant can just blow the shit out of this place with you slagjackers still inside.
All right, come on in.
Just like that? You don't want me to toss my gun in the river or anything like that?
Would you do it if I told you to?
Most likely not.
Then I won't waste my time. Besides, you're the one with the ace on the line, not us.
Very astute.
The skin between Kane's shoulder blades seemed to tighten, and the short hairs at the back of his neck tingled. Something, some small, almost unidentifiable stimulus, had triggered a mental alarm, what Kane called his point man's sense. As Kane took a final drag on his cigar before dropping it and crushing it underfoot, he spoke into his contact.
I'm going in.
Nice bluff about the rocket launcher.
Yes, let's hope they don't call it.
They're definitely up to something.
No shit.
A big man in overalls and a red t-shirt, and sporting a wild beard, stepped up and blocked the doorway into the building. He carried a 30-30 lever-action rifle, keeping his body turned so he could bring it up at a moment's notice. The fast-fading light glinted dully from the Millennial Consortium button pinned to the frayed, stretched-out collar of his shirt.
I'm Broderick. I own this place. How many are out there in the bush?
Does it make any difference? It's the issue of your being outgunned, not outnumbered.
Broderick glowered, considered the implications of the comment, and moved aside. Kane stepped over the threshold, squinting until his eyes adjusted to the gloom. The interior of the station glowed from animal fat lanterns hanging from ceiling hooks. He saw three of the hellhounds, still in their body armor, shifting in the chairs where they sat at a big wooden table. Earthenware mugs, poker chips, and cards were scattered across it. Carthew stood in a corner near the window, peering out intently for any sign of Kane's companions. At first, Kane thought the one-eyed man had his arms folded over his chest, but then realized he was cradling his torso.
Take a seat.
Kane scanned the room. It was barren of any creature comforts, possessing only a long wooden slab serving as a bar and the half-dozen chairs scattered around the table. Behind the bar, a long board rested on spikes driven into the planks at 45-degree angles. Bottles and jugs were lined up on the makeshift shelf. Yellowed animal skulls were nailed to the walls between old regional maps of the western states. The floor was hard-packed dirt, bisected in several places by deep cracks. The cloying stench of human sweat and home-brewed liquor clung to the air.
Leave it open. This place really needs to air out.
Is that right?
Kane uncoiled, almost too fast for the eye to follow. He pivoted at the waist, drawing his pistol in the same motion. He hit the man across the forehead with the barrel. The blade sight tearing a bloody gash in his flesh. The man crashed backward, bounced off the door, and staggered forward right into Kane's left fist. He dropped his rifle and fell, landing at the feet of the Hellhounds at the card table. They went for their weapons. The Hellhounds still wore their mag-issue sin-eaters, snugged in power holsters strapped to their right forearms. As fast as they were, Kane was faster. The Bren 10 spit three subsonic rounds through the tabletop.
What's going on?
Just making a point.
One of the Hellhounds, a black-haired man in his mid-30s, wiped at the stinging liquid on his face.
We got it.
Hands on the table.
Kane kicked Broderick's rifle out of reach.
Carthew, put yours where I can see them.
I'd like to accommodate you, Kane. I really would, but my hands are all that's keeping my guts off the floor.
Kane flicked his gaze toward him. The one-eyed man's face was drawn, his chin speckled with blood. Kane figured he suffered from punctured, perhaps even collapsed, lungs. Several ribs were probably broken, too.
And your sidearm?
It's out of ammo.
Take it off anyway.
I'll try.
Just do it. And you three at the table, too. Move slow.
As they complied with Kane's order, undoing the straps and Velcro tabs of their holsters, Broderick stirred on the floor. One hand over the bleeding laceration in his forehead, he crawled away from the table and pulled himself up, sitting down in one of the chairs. He steadfastly avoided looking in Kane's direction. Kane backstepped to the door and lifted the locking bar, pulling the door open, glad for the whiff of fresh air.
We're in position now. Ready for your signal.
Stand by.
The three Hellhounds tossed their sin-eaters to the floor near the bar. Kane glanced back over at Carthew. The man leaned against the wall, struggling to undo a buckle.
You need any help? Want me to shoot it off?
Leave him alone!
What's your name, kid?
Vance.
Kane gestured casually with the barrel of his Bren 10 toward the red embossed disc on Vance's left pectoral.
How long were you badged before you went rogue?
2 months. How about you?
I was closing in on 17 years, I guess. That's why I knew how to keep my fucking mouth shut when facing a man with a gun. But if you were a mag for only 2 months, I suppose you never had the chance to grasp that. So look at this as a learning experience, if I let you live through it.
Vance swallowed hard and lowered his gaze. Kane's hard, humorless grin widened. Women sometimes confused him. Circumstances disturbed him. But he knew how to deal with magistrates, even former ones. If they saw even a glimmer of fear in his eyes, so much as a twitch of apprehension on his face, the four men would react like predators scenting fresh spilled blood. Carthew dropped his holster and sin-eater to the dirt floor. He continued hugging himself.
Done.
Thanks. Now it's time for a Q&A.
What?
Question and answer. For example, I know who's paying the bills on this marauder operation of yours, but I want to know where and why.
You know how it works, Kane. What do I get out of it?
Your life, for starters.
I don't think I have much more of it. You'll have to offer me a trade, like give me something for the pain. A good mag like you wouldn't be out here in the asshole of the world without a medical kit.
I think you'll be more talkative without being doped up. Move over into the light. Sit down with the rest of your crew.
Carthew took a shuffling sidestep toward the table, then sagged, nearly doubling over.
I can't make it.
He coughed up pink foam, squeezing his eyes shut. Kane moved toward him.
Fuck. I'm losing it.
As if his legs had turned to molten wax, he sank toward the floor, half falling forward into Kane's arms. As soon as he caught him, Kane knew he had fallen for a ploy so old he nearly gagged on the humiliating realization. Carthew's arms whipped from around his midsection and clasped Kane tightly at the elbows, pressing them close against his sides. The cracked section of the dirt floor rose, and a man and a gun rose with it. In a fraction of a second, Kane understood the mechanics of the trap. Carthew had lured him into a position to be backshot by the long-haired man who had lain doggo in the shallow trench. Because of the fading light, Kane couldn't make out the man's features, but he definitely recognized the outline of a big revolver. The three Hellhounds leaped from their chairs, reaching for their weapons. Broderick made a wild scramble for his rifle, which was lying almost in the doorway. Kane pivoted at the waist and swung Carthew around so he was in the line of fire.
Oh, God damn it, you motherfucker!
Carthew grappled with Kane, trying to wrestle him back in front of the revolver's muzzle.
A little help here.
Well, you ain't gonna get it from me, you bastard!
Although Carthew wasn't as seriously wounded as he made out to be, he was still injured. However, he retained enough strength to immobilize Kane's arms and stab him repeatedly with the knife blade he had concealed in his gauntlet. Kane felt the knife thrust as a repeated poking pressure, uncomfortable and even a little irritating, but not painful. The blade couldn't penetrate the dense molecular structure of the shadow suit fabric. Twisting, Kane stopped trying to fight his way out of Carthew's hug. Instead, he lifted his right arm, bending it at the elbow, and squeezed the trigger of the Bren 10. Vance and the other hellhounds turned over the table. They scuttled behind it as if it were a shield.
Kane! What's going on?
Kane drove the top of his head into Carthew's face, right at the bridge of his nose. The X-Mag's head snapped back, blood springing from his nostrils. As he stumbled backward, his grip loosened and Kane wrenched himself from between the prison of the man's polycarbonate shod arms. The man standing knee-deep in the ditch waved his big board hand cannon.
Look this way, you interfering son of a bitch!
Kane whirled toward him as the man squeezed the trigger. The heavy caliber round struck the barrel of the Bren 10 with a spurt of sparks. White-hot agony exploded up and down Kane's arm, a nova of pain flaring in his wrist and carpals. The pistol was torn from his grasp and scuttled end over end across the interior of the trading post.
I meant to do that!
He stepped up out of the trench, aligning Kane's head in front of his pistol's sight. Through his pain-blurred vision, Kane recognized the revolver as a .357 Colt King Cobra, known in the pre-dark days as a man-breaker. Kane waited to be broken. Suddenly, the man's face acquired an expression of vacant foolishness. His lips worked as if he were trying to think of something to say. Then he fell forward. From the rear of his skull protruded the blade of a tomahawk, the long handle extending down between his shoulder blades. Kane glimpsed Skydog on the other side of the barred window. Kane threw himself forward over the back of a chair, somersaulted, and came up running, holding the chair ahead of him by the legs, using it as a shield and a battering ram. One of the hellhounds raised himself from behind the table and snapped a shot at him. Kane shielded himself with the chair. One bullet bit a wedge out of the corner of the thick wooden seat, while another bullet chunked solidly into the seat but didn't penetrate. Kane threw the chair at the armored man, and as he ducked, Kane left the floor in a long dive, hurling himself behind the bar, ducking instinctively as another bullet plowed through the flimsy wood and lodged in the wall behind him. Broderick and the three hellhounds fired a ragged, poorly aimed fusillade, the impact of the rounds dislodging the shelf above him. Kane covered up, trying to protect himself from the shower of falling jugs and glasses. He crawled swiftly through the broken shards and pools of foul-smelling liquor, his right wrist in agony. A notion occurred to Kane as he peered up at the underside of the bar, groping with his left hand until his fingers touched the walnut stock of the sawed-off shotgun attached to the slab of pine by a hook and a length of wire. He yanked it down. Kane scrambled toward the end of the bar. Peering cautiously around it, he could see the doorway with Broderick standing beside it. Not 15 feet away lay the overturned table behind which three of the hellhounds knelt. He spotted Carthew crouched in the corner, but trying to nail him was risky. With presumably only two shells in the double-barreled gun, he couldn't risk firing one at random, hoping to score a hit by good luck alone. At that second, Grant and Bridget Baptiste burst into the trading post through the front and back doors. Grant lunged through the open front door, leading with his copperhead, the butt jammed against his shoulder, the laser auto-targeter casting a bright red kill dot on the bib of Broderick's overalls.
Drop it!
Broderick didn't drop it, but he froze for a split second, finger around the trigger of the rifle. Kane saw Vance's blonde curls rising smoothly into sight from behind the table, his sin-eater coming up to center on Grant. Vance flailed across the room, tripped on the body of the man lying half in and half out of the trench, and toppled against Carthew.
Shit!
The other two hellhounds turned their attention to Kane, sinews hammering. Bridget squeezed off a long burst from her copperhead. Three bullets caught a man in the side of his head. Hanks of hair, a flap of scalp, and a piece of ear exploded outward in a clot of blood. Several more rounds pounded into the other X-Mag's armored torso, sending him stumbling, arms windmilling, his boot soles grating on the floor, seeking purchase. Broderick's bewhiskered lips writhed back over his discolored teeth, and he jerked the barrel of his rifle in a short arc toward Grant, hand working the trigger and the lever. The first two shots went wild. Grant fired his subgun immediately. A triplet of dark holes appeared in the bib of the man's overalls, stitching him from navel to sternum. The bearded man staggered, still firing the rifle. Grant shot him again, through the throat. Gobbets of muscle and tissue tore away. A few globs of blood spewed from his lips, but he didn't fall. Recovering his balance, he put the rifle to his shoulder and aimed at Grant. The left side of Broderick's face erupted in a scarlet spray, his eye and nose vanishing in a bloody smear. For a couple of seconds, his feet twitched like landed fish. The surviving hellhound pushed himself from the fallen Carthew, holding up both hands.
Don't kill me. I'm done. I give up.
Kane scrambled erect, the acrid fumes of cordite burning his nostrils and eyes. He exchanged swift glances with Bridget and then Grant. They surveyed the smoky, blood-spattered, corpse-littered interior of the trading post with silent, almost shocked eyes. Skydog cautiously peered around the doorframe.
So, this is what you mean by brazening it out?